Okay. Right, everyone. I've been looking forward to this event for several weeks now. When Mechi mentioned that she would be coming to the country. I've just got a few announcements to make before I go through this very brief, pictorially, enhanced presentation of introduction. Basically, this event is going to be recorded, OK? I think we circulated everyone with that news. Mechi and I are desperately trying to forget that it's going to be recorded, but a recording will be available afterwards for those of you who couldn't make it. I also want to just draw your attention here to the... we have a special Twitter hashtag for this event tonight. As you can see, hashtag LSE Della Rocha. And if you want to join in the conversation afterwards, which I'm sure will be very stimulating, then please put that hashtag, and here are some other crucial Twitter handles that you might also want to put in your tweets. I'd also like to just mention that Mercedes very kindly is giving a super classic, okay, because we don't like master classic, but there's no such thing as there as master class in Mexican Spanish, so it's called a super classic, and that is happening on Thursday afternoon between 4 and 6, and is open to PhDs who speak Spanish. So in case you haven't become aware of that event, it was meant to be circulated via the Latin American and Caribbean Center, but if you would very much like to go to the event, I think there are a couple of places left, so please, if you could email Karen Harris, that's k.harris@lse.ac.uk, and I will be chairing that event as well. It's going to be a special session in which we're going to explore issues of methodology, which have been central to Mercedes' work. So without further ado, and I will get through this very quickly, I promise you, Mercedes is not a geographer. Mercedes started out in life doing a BA in social anthropology in Mexico, and then followed directly from that to an MA in economic and social studies at the University of Manchester. That was where Mercedes and her husband, Agustin Escobar, first encountered Brian Roberts. And then Brian Roberts ended up supervising Mercedes and Agustin's PhDs in the early 1980s. And Mercedes, for the last 30 years, I think, has been professor of social anthropology at Ciesas del Occidente, which is a very highly esteemed institution in Mexico for the social sciences. Mechi has so many distinctions. When she actually sent me her CV, an updated CV, it was like a small book. It was about 30 pages long. It took me quite a long time to read, but I tried to select out some of the key highlights. Some of you will already be familiar with Mercedes' books, which have dated right the way from the 1980s through to the current decade, and some images there, which some of them are screen grabs, I'm afraid, not particularly brilliant on my part, but you can recognise some of those covers, I'm sure. In addition to that, Mercedes has actually won various prizes, including for her first major book, Los Recursos de la Pobreza, or The Resources of Poverty. She also won a very prestigious Casa Chata Prize in 2002 for her very famous and widely cited paper on private adjustments, household responses to the erosion of work. Mechi also came to Cambridge in the middle part of the first decade of this century as Simon Bolivar Professor in the Center for Latin American Studies there. She's been recognized in Mexico for her long service at CSS Occidente, and she's also a member of the Mexican National System of Researchers, which I believe is a very hard club to get into. So well done, Mechi, for that. Now, for the fun part, I just want to reveal to you that Mechi and I actually go back several years now, right from 1982. But of course, in 1982, we didn't have digital cameras, and in fact, I don't think I had a camera in 1982 because we were very poor PhD students. But some of these pictures date from our early days of doctoral fieldwork, postdoctoral research. As you can see, we're working very hard at it, accompanied by a couple of bottles of tecate or whatever. These are actually all in Mexico, but this one here is at the SAS conference in 1999, and I can't remember where, I think it was in Leeds. But anyway, we've certainly kept in regular contact, and here we are again with growing families, me with a second husband by that stage. So we've been doing well over the years. This is a conference which was organised in Princeton by
Maria Patricia
Fernandez Kelly, and he's Cortez, Alejandro Cortez. So we've got Brian Roberts here, Javier Ayuera, Robert Gay, amongst others, and of course, Mercedes and me. This is when Mercedes was in Cambridge. We went up to visit her, and we love this picture because it's completely accidental. This is when we went to see the Carlo exhibition, Frida Kahlo exhibition at the Tate, modern, and we hadn't realised at the time that we are perfectly coordinated with our outfits and the chairs. And we didn't realise that until after. So that one has to feature in our presentation. More drinks here in 2007, where there was a big conference in Mexico within Mujeres, the Coneval and UNIFEM. We were having some of the freebies there, and then tucking into a large dinner somewhere in Coyoacán. This is in Finsbury Park. This is in Barcelona, where we went to Lourdes Benaria's retirement do and had a good good time, didn't we, when we went to Barcelona? And then last but not least, this is Mercedes' son, Diego, who's now doing a PhD, and his wife. This is Gareth Jones. Some of you may have spotted Gareth in the LSE, but this is Gareth when we went to dinner in Finsbury Park not so long ago. This is me in CSS, when Mechi very kindly invited me. But, of course, Diego fell in love with Denise. This is Mechi back in 1986, when I first, I knew you before you even got pregnant.
Exactly.
I think, yes. And this is a little bit...
We met when Diego was born.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember him as a very, very sweet baby. He's an even nicer adult. And that is what came from that. I know that Mechi is now spending 2 days a week looking after baby Amelia, who was born earlier this year. Okay, so, right. So, Mercedes' key research interests over the years have included gender and household survival or livelihoods. Don't forget, Mechi and I were first starting our PhDs at a time when Mexico had just suffered the oil crisis, and then, of course, went through a swinging suite of structural adjustment reforms. So we were working on households in poverty at a very dynamically changing time. Mercedes is also famous for her work on conditional cash transfer programs, and particularly the prototype Mexican one, which started off as Oportunidades
Progresa,
and is now called Prospera. Okay, but it's gone through various incarnations. And also, Mechi has been particularly interested in social exclusion and work. And so tonight, we're talking to the theme of survival and social exchange, the relevance of giving, receiving, and reciprocating. So welcome, Mechi. Right, okay, so we get out of this.
The T-shirt got very emotional.
You got emotional?
Yeah.
So...
photographs.
I know, it takes us back. Well, we haven't changed a bit, really.
No, we haven't.
Well, not in character, I don't think. So here we go. Now, slideshow. From here, from current slide, and you should be fine, Mitch.
Yes, we've got you.
All right.
Well, never mind about the tissue. This is too hard to open.
Do you want me to?
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
That's mine.
Oh, how nice.
I need my glasses. Sorry about this. I forget I have to use glasses nowadays. I promise this is the last interruption. Right. Thank you. Well, thank you, Sylvia, for this beautiful and, for me, quite emotional introduction. Thank you for all of you being here this afternoon. Are you following me? Are you listening to me? Okay. And, of course, I want to thank Professor Sylvia Shunt for the opportunity to be here this afternoon, to Dr. Ryan Settner, and, of course, to Professor Gary Jones, who all three of them organized and made this possible, this seminar possible. I want to start by giving you three examples from different countries and different times, which make us think about the importance of social networking and social engagement for people, particularly poor people. When I say that social isolation kills, is because you can actually gather information and evidence from many places, in many times, which support the idea that people, when they are disengaged from their social networks of support, then they actually face very hard times. I am going to start with the work written by Stephen Devereux, or Devereux, I don't know. He is a British and South American development economist. He's a research fellow at the IDS, so it's very close he lives and works in Britain. And he's devoted to do research on food security, hunger, rural livelihoods, and social protection and poverty reduction issues. I just came across one of his papers, and actually I was looking for information and some support papers when I was writing another piece of work, which is on vulnerability. And I came across his work, and I was very much interested because he's writing this paper in 1999, quite a long time ago, particularly exactly the time when I started thinking and writing on social isolation. Anyway, he examines the role of the informal safety nets in providing protection against livelihood shocks in Malawi. According to this author, informal safety nets are a subset of coping strategies that people adopt in response to episodes of acute food shortage or insecurity. And he argues that informal safety nets are one manifestation of social capital or the moral economy, and they involve drawing on social networks for assistance in times of need, many times with expectations of reciprocity. It's interesting what he founds. He founds that these types of transactions are non-market, as we all know, and range from remittances of food or cash within families to meal sharing between neighbors on interest-free loans, between friends, as well as gifts. These informal transfers appear to be declining over time as a consequence of deepening poverty. Deepening poverty, as he says, curtails the ability of people to respond to requests for assistance. Let's go to another example. This is from a wonderful book written long time ago, in 1986, I think. I found my way. written by Katharina Lies. She's a Belgian historian, currently professor emeritus in one university in Brussels, whose name is quite difficult for me, Vrije University of Brussels. Her PhD thesis was published as that book, The Social Change on the Laboring Poor. It is the story of one of the Brussels, Belgium cities, how they became a poor city and so on. Her main research interests are industrialization, poverty, and social policy. And her main interlocutor is Michael Anderson, the great British historian and sociologist who studied the impact of urban industrial life in the kinship system in England of the working classes in the 19th century in Lancashire. Anderson had shown, as you might remember, that networks are crucial for families engaged in the industrialization process. Networks are important when families cope with illness, unemployment, death, and old age. Katharina Lies explored the extent to which the lower classes in poor cities develop social networks, as Anderson had shown for 19th century Lancashire. And she founds that families disintegrate in places where casual labor became increasingly more important. And that is crucial to my argument today. Are family-based strategies the most adequate and rational response to growing material insecurity? Katharina Lies asks herself. She found that beyond certain level of poverty, mutual help becomes inoperative if people do not have enough resources to keep them alive. They are in no state to provide assistance to others. In other words, unemployment and increasing poverty made the future uncertain and limited reciprocity. In sum, as Antwerp lost its craft tradition and became a port city, in the European context of rapid industrialization, unemployment increased and poverty rose. In this context, according to this author, the protective functions of families eroded. Now, I call your attention for another very interesting book. If you haven't read these books, I really, please consider getting some copies or getting them in internet, because they are extremely interesting for the purpose of thinking on poverty and the impact of poverty in social life. This is a book written by Eric Klinenberg. And it's Eric Klinenberg I am absolutely disorganized. Sorry. No, I don't, actually. Yeah, I have trouble looking at my notes. No difference. Oh, that's worse. Oh, that's much better. Probably it's not so good for you in terms of the presentation, but that is absolutely great for me. I thought, oh my goodness, LSE has become poorer. Perhaps they don't have money to pay for the electricity. Anyway, Eric Klinenberg is a sociologist, American sociologist, interested in urban studies. He is a professor in sociology and public policy at NYU, the New York University. And he wrote this magnificent book, which is called Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, published by the University of Chicago in 2002. It's an oldish, but very, very interesting and very pertinent to what I'm doing today and what I'm planning to argue in my paper. So Klinenberg analyzes the impact of the 1995 heat wave on massive deaths, which particularly elderly males suffered, which particularly African American males, old males, suffered. These were above the norm deaths. That is, they would not have happened if the heat wave had not been so deadly, and if the social conditions in which these old men lived in would be different. According to Klinenberg, even the most sophisticated meteorological analysis still left unexplained a fair amount of variance in the mortality measure. That is to say that the weather accounts for only part of the human devastation that arose from the Chicago heat wave. Therefore, the disaster, as all disasters, because there is no natural disasters, so this disaster has a social etiology, which Klinenberg is interested in finding out, that is, the human dimensions of the catastrophe. So let's go to my own work. And I beg your pardon, I have to really apologize for having such a rusty English. So because of my very poor English, I really prefer to read my paper. I know it's not nice, I know it is a little bit boring, but I really prefer to do it, otherwise I will be lost in the universe. Right. Research and thinking on household responses to economic change are part of a long-standing tradition in Latin America. In Mexico, social scientists have devoted considerable attention to the understanding of rural and urban households and the peasant economy, to the impact of migration, urbanization, and industrialization on household dynamics, to the patterns of labor, livelihoods, and the ways in which the urban poor cope or fail to cope with poverty and economic disadvantage. From marginality theory during the 60s and early 70s in last century to the views regarding the new poverty of today, Latin American scholars have carefully assessed the impacts, of social and economic change on the private space of families and households. As households focused research developed in the region, the emphasis on adaptation strategies disseminated rapidly. As a participant in this tradition, I have both benefited from and contributed to the knowledge of the choices and constraints of the poor in Latin American societies. When the Mexican economic crisis, 80s, 90s, triggered major reforms, it was necessary to revisit previous studies, including mine, which had emphasized the resourcefulness of the poor. During the 80s, our empirical research enabled us to understand poverty and household arrangements as dynamic, changing realities, and the poor as active participants in the making of their own lives and livelihoods, in spite of major economic changes. Survival and reproduction of the poor, in contexts shaped by low wages and scant support from the state, were left in the hands of the poor themselves. Households were seen as the main scenario for survival in contexts of limited resources, while families and social networks were understood as the archetype for protection against misfortune and economic distress. But our findings and positions were abused by Mexican and international aid and development agencies as proving proof that the poor could and would cope with additional reforms that lowered wages and decreased wage-earning opportunities, replaced general price-based subsidies with targeted transfers, and otherwise impacted their ability to extract incomes from an economy transition from a given model of development to a certain something else. What is at stake here is a model of development that extols the virtues of private initiatives and private solutions to macroeconomic problems, while at the same time it cripples persons' and families' abilities to successfully adapt to economic change and their contribution to growth and well-being. In this paper, I draw from my own long-standing research interests and findings on the shifting dynamics of household organization to examine the process that has led to social isolation among the poor in Mexico. In so doing, I re-examine the widespread notion of the resourcefulness of the poor, their assumed endless capacity to work more, to consume less, and to take part in mutual help networks. According to this notion, aggressive and violent economic shocks make little difference. The always good poor keep on working, reciprocating, and relying on their own safety nets. This view had disastrous consequences for Mexico and for many other Latin American societies. From the mid-80s onwards, the retreat of the state from a number of social security functions, the privatization of social services, and the dismantling of provisions and subsidies aimed at lowering the cost of living of the poor, together with poor economic performance, produced the most serious worsening of poverty in Latin America during the 20th century. Latin American governments and international institutions such as the World Bank have, as a result, begun to reappraise their views and policies. Once again, nowadays, the state is seen as responsible for the design and implementation of policies that should reduce poverty and ideally enable the poor to participate more fully in national development. New policies, such as the previously mentioned Programa Oportunidades or CCT's programs in Latin America, new policies are in place in a number of countries. I say this, inverted commas, because they are not so new anymore. Oportunidades is celebrating its 18th birthday or something like that. It started in 1997. So this type of new policy, because I emphasize that it's new, because it's a totally different approach of the role of the state, right, from the liberal absence of the state from these type of problems, now it is more present. So these new policies are in place in a number of countries, and some analysts believe social policy has undergone a paradigm change from a liberal perspective to one that provides a renewed role of the state. Social scientists, and particularly those working on household economies, played a role in both trends. First, by their emphasis on the ability of the poor to cope under duress, and more recently, by insisting that this ability was not endless and that it had reached a dead end. This is an account of how, in the span of 30 years, research in Mexico responded to a changing reality and moved from one emphasis to the other. During these 30 years, I argue, the poor have undergone a process leading to social isolation. This process can be understood as the outcome of three distinct but related phenomena. First, the erosion of work or the increasing precariousness of employment. Second, a paradoxical de-diversification of household work strategies. And third, the private adjustments that have taken place at the household level and their limits. Thirty years ago, I started doing research in Guadalajara, the second largest city in Mexico, on the ways in which households are shaped by labor market dynamics. I argued that the agency of the poor is framed and shaped by labor market opportunities, development strategies of societies, and social and economic policies that either facilitate or constrain survival, social mobility, and reproduction. That research was conducted during the last years of import substitution industrialization and 1 year before the onslaught of the severe economic crisis that led to the Latin American lost decade. I proposed that the resources of poverty, or the ability of the poor to survive, depended on a household strategy of diversification of income sources and multiple income earners. Labor markets offered low wages, but informal and formal employment coexisted and acted as viable options. Workers could choose formal or informal work, although the photograph is not the perfect photo to show this coexistence of different activities within households. So workers could choose between formal or informal jobs, in many cases a combination of both, according to their needs and their advantages among different jobs, time schedules, flexibility, benefits, salaries, etc. The informal sector represented in the early 80s an attractive, viable alternative with similar or even higher wages than those offered by formal jobs. Income derived from wages comprised an important source for nourishing livelihoods, but household economies relied heavily on petty commodity production and petty trade, domestic production of goods and services for consumption, and goods and services from social exchange through networks of informal systems of support. A collective and diversified income generating strategy, not free of conflicts, negotiations, and uneven workloads and rewards, was documented. Questioning how subsequent crises, economic policies, and labor markets transformation would affect the lives of the working poor in urban Mexico and other countries, I have devoted my research and thinking to understanding household responses to economic change or the private adjustments taking place at the household level. In the early 1980s, I found very few socially isolated households and socially isolated individuals. These were considered deviant cases because I did find some families and households and individuals which were isolated, but I considered them deviant cases since the majority of the poor belonged to strong, though flexible, constellations of social relationships of kin, neighbors, and friends. Since socially isolated households were empirically the poorest of the poor, these deviant cases were included in the analysis to demonstrate the devastating consequences of social isolation and the crucial uplifting effect of social exchange on the well-being of the poor. Everyday life and social reproduction could only be explained in contexts of poverty by taking social exchange within social networks into account. Today, social isolation is one of the outstanding characteristics of large segments of the poor in Mexico and the rest of Latin America. According to a survey conducted by the Mexican federal government in the early years of 2000, 51% of the poor did not have anybody to rely on for childcare support. More than 60% thought that friends do not provide well-being, and only 6% accepted that belonging to civil associations brings some kind of benefit. Almost 20% thought that nobody would help them in case of unemployment, and similar amounts of individuals declared to have null support from relatives, neighbors, or friends when they go hungry or homeless. So, from the glorious analysis of the 70s and 80s of last century, where social networks blossomed and seemed to be working smoothly for the poor, the new century brought rising difficulties for social exchange. More recent analysis, as the one myself and my colleagues did in, and it's a published work in 2016, if you are interested, I can talk about that later, show that social networks are, for an increasing number of people, drained and fragile as a result of lack of resources to participate both in the circuit of monetary exchanges as well as in the circuit of care and service exchange, services exchange. My interpretation of social isolation as a growing phenomenon has been enlightened by a perspective which, instead of stressing the resources of poverty as endless and unlimited, explores the limits and constraints for accessing and exchanging resources. I'm going to talk now to the erosion, about the erosion of work. I argue that wage income constitutes a major ingredient in urban poor people's livelihoods, and not simply one among several type of resources. By presenting the scenario of the growing deterioration of wages and work conditions, my aim is to show the large extent to which livelihoods opportunities are being affected by the erosion of work. During the last three decades, Mexico has gone through processes of economic and social change, characterized by severe economic crisis, adjustment policies, economic restructuring, and a rapid and relatively successful integration of the Mexican economy to world markets with a growing emphasis in export-oriented production. Export-oriented production, however, is highly concentrated both geographically and in terms of economic sectors and branches of manufacturing production. The opening to both imports and exports had a dramatic impact on Mexican firms, especially small and medium-sized manufacturing enterprises, which found the competition with commodities produced abroad as a challenge too difficult to sustain. As a result, many firms closed down and too many jobs were lost. According to Escobar, the 1994 financial crisis signaled a watershed for Mexican labor markets because for the first time since 1982, the population did not respond with a general intensification of work and informal employment. Instead, unemployment soared, and its abatement after 1995 was better interpreted as a result of withdrawal from the job search rather than the successful completion of the search for work, since male employment continued to fall. Integration to world markets entailed a diminishing capacity of the Mexican government to regulate and control prices, wages, and the creation of employment. In this context, formal employment became even leaner and insufficient to meet the needs of a still young population, and whose working age segment, people between 15 and 64 years old, is and will continue rising rapidly. But employment creation is not enough, and it is concentrated in some economic niches, highly specialized and earmarked by workers and employees with special credentials. As a result, most workers do not have employment options, but casual labor, and choices are, for a growing number of them, no longer possible. Non-permanent, unreliable, casual labor has become a critically important source of household income. It is, however, characterized by very low and irregular wages, especially in urban areas where the market has become saturated and there is a high degree of competition for jobs. Unemployment reached unprecedented levels at the end of the 90s, at the same something which had never happened before. And at the same time, the amount of people occupied in precarious conditions is also high and growing. Working conditions are, for the majority of workers, deplorable. This is 2006 data from a very particularly well perform survey with a good reputation, according to that survey, which is the ENOE, Encuesta Nacional de Ocupaciones y Empleo, 74 of employed men do not have a contract. 70%, 74% of occupied men do not have a contract. And 61% of these working men lack any type of benefits. Women are, of course, not better off. And the figures are around those very, very high figures, 70, 60. Most of the workers then are working in Mexico under very bad conditions, without contract, without benefits, without holidays, without anything similar to any social benefit. An essential change that must be noted is that individuals and households are no longer able to choose from alternative forms of employment. So only these very informal jobs are now seem to be available right now. So changes taking place in the employment structure have drastically affected poverty levels in Mexico. During the last 30 years, formal employment decreased in absolute and relative terms, and minimum wages lost a good deal of their purchasing power, 56% of the purchasing power was lost at the end of the 80s, that very, very, very difficult time in the whole Latin America. By far the largest decrease in Latin America during that period of time, according to Lourdes Veneria. During the worst years of the economic crisis in the 80s, government spending on health and on social security was lower, and state subsidies were significantly reduced. Therefore, there was a quite clear decrease in income levels and a rise in the number of the poor, both rural and urban, while the country's population expanded from 71 to 81 million, from 81 to 87, the poor increased their numbers from 32 to 41 million, and almost half of them were considered to be extremely poor. The ability to cushion the blows of each successive crisis and to elude falling into poverty had worn out for the most part. After a few years of economic recovery in the 90s, a recovery that by all means was insufficient to heal the wounds and cuts that the previous disastrous years had produced, another decade came along, with more crises and insecure horizons for the already debilitated poor. Real wages decreased during the 90s, and per capita monetary income did not attain, in the year 2000, the levels it had reached in 1992. Consequently, absolute and relative poverty rose. The Mexican economy was, in the year 2000, the 10th in the world, but a quarter of Mexico's population did not have enough money, enough income, to buy a basic basket of food. While 54% of the Mexican people could not afford food, education, health services, housing, clothing, and transport. Not only the number of poor people increased during the 90s, but also the poor became poorer along this period of time. Just a paragraph to today's picture. The most recent poverty measurement, which is carried out by a very prestigious and very systematic, very rigid, very, very well-known institution in Mexico, which is called Coneval, which is in charge of the measurement of poverty and the evaluation of social policy. So that most recent poverty measurement, which was carried out in 2014, indicated an increase in the percentage of poor households from 2012 to 2014, from 45 to 46% and so on. So, poverty is one of the most important problems in Mexico, and although not only a simple matter of income, it is deeply related to precarious employment, very low wages and in general to very scarce and increasingly narrow economic opportunities. I'm going to talk about the limits of diversification. Along the above described process of work erosion, increasing unemployment, precariousness, and insecurity of labor markets, a paradoxical de-diversification of household work strategies took place. The erosion of work seriously affected household livelihoods, traditionally nurtured by the collective participation of household members in diverse, tangible, and intangible income-producing activities. I argue that wages do not only fuel household consumption economies, but also trigger other income-generating activities, including self-employment, self-provisioning, and social exchange. This closely corresponds to the findings of RAPAL in this country in the early 80s in Britain. My research had documented the increasing constraints and growing numbers of men, the increasing constraints that growing numbers of men and women face in order to start a family business or to continue self-employment and self-provisioning duties when regular income from wages stopped flowing into the household economy. They simply do not have money to buy materials or to cover transportation expenses. This means that self-provisioning activities and, in general, income from sources other than wages diminishes in contexts of growing unemployment and labor market precariousness. As a result, the diversity of income sources within households through the participation of household members in various different types of wage and non-wage activities or the traditional base to achieve survival fades away. Precarious employment was present in the pre-crisis and restructuring times, but it coexisted with formal employment and autonomous income sources, and most importantly, was one of various options open to the poor. Today's context is characterized by a combination of lack of jobs, what people experience as unemployment or not finding a job, and precarious employment for the majority of workers, while permanent employment has become rare and only available for an increasing reduced number of them. A new type of segmentation seems to be emerging, not along the formal and informal lines, as we used to say long time ago, but between a privileged group of workers permanently employed and the vast majority who struggle to survive with very scarce resources amidst precarious employment and unemployment, or subemployment, as we say in Mexico, subempleo. The absence of regular incomes from at least one household member makes it even more difficult to start or to continue autonomous projects. In households, on the contrary, in which monetary income flows in regularly, people have a wider margin to devote time and other resources, including money, to self-provisioning and household production, and, of course, for social networking. Paradoxically, while the number of people who experience the erosion of work is growing, household economies largely depend on money coming from wages in order to satisfy consumption needs and to implement household survival strategies that comprise the participation of household members in diverse income-earning activities, including social exchange. According to a rigorous analysis, household expenditure practices and consumption patterns are largely monetary today in Mexico, both in rural as much as in urban areas, with a very small part of total consumption in those households being covered by non-monetary sources, such as gifts, self-provisioning, or in-kind payments. This picture appears very contradictory indeed. Wage income has gained terrain to the extent that it constitutes a major ingredient in poor people's livelihoods at the time when waged employment is less available. to major groups of the population. Labor force, the most abundant and traditionally crucial resource in the hands of the poor, has become the most redundant, leading to unfeasible diversification strategies. This is what I have called the shift from the resources of poverty to the, as a model of survival to the poverty of resources. It is not surprising, then, that the process of de-diversification of household strategies has meant severe cuts and adjustments to which I now turn my attention. Okay, by private adjustments, I refer to the array of changes that have taken place within households as they face crisis and so on. Private responses implemented at the household level are intended to compensate for the loss of individual wages during economic change and to help overcome family emergencies. According to my ethnographic research, I have documented the shifts and trade-offs that household members perform as households adjust to economic change. Research conducted along the 80s and 90s and early 2000s showed the types of restrictions and not simply transformations that the poor have been obliged to implement in their lives. I stress that changes taking place within households have suppressed or limited household members' social practices. And I really want to stress that it's not changes or transformations only, but really restrictions and very deep transformations. Household adjustment has not only been enforced in consumption through a general withdrawal from the market and overall practice of tightening the belt, as a growing number of individuals are rejected from formal. Your 7-minute notice made me extremely. Okay, I'm going to just go through my notes here in the presentation. Yes, perhaps the most important thing here is to stress that households have to have monetary incomes to cover the social fund. When I say social fund, I really stress the importance of these resources devoted to all the activities that are in, that are part of the engagement in social groups. But the way that all the economic change that has been forcing people to actually get out of social networks because they don't have the money to cover that social fund and be socially isolated. So in my view, the literature, if you look at it, you can see that there has been two types of emphasis. Some part of the authors and the literature goes to stress that social isolation is a process of social and physical segregation. For example, you have the work by Teresa Caldeiras, who I know she was here not very long ago. But I also refer to the social isolation process as a process of weakening social links among the poor. And that kind of social engagement, is based on reciprocity, which is the base of networks and informal support system. And what I've been stressing over a few years already is that reciprocity is not a virtue. It's not just a natural thing that we are born with, just by given by something, a very strong nature or from God or whatever. No, reciprocity is something which has costs and is socially constructed and has its limits. And when you don't have resources to actually nurture that social machinery which is behind social networking, then you just fail to be engaged. So my conclusion is that social change and adjustment and economic change have meant a process of cumulative disadvantages for the poor. What I mean when I use the term cumulative disadvantages, it's a notion that alludes to the snowballing effect or impact that the erosion of work has had on various other dimensions of life, of the people. I mean, the lives of the poor are not only working, for, of course, but work and regular, secure, protected work is extremely important for this machinery to actually work. In other words, in my view, the poor are more vulnerable when joblessness, precariousness, and social isolation are combined in a perverse ensemble of disadvantages. I don't know if you have come across a book, which is already quite oldish. I don't like why, as I become older, I like old people, I like old authors, I like old books, and so on. But this book I'm referring to, which is not cited here, is a book called Disadvantages by two philosophers who actually do research, which is very strange for a philosopher. And they argue very similar things that to my argument. They talk about clusters of disadvantages, and they argue that disadvantages tend to be together. They tend to be to appear together with other disadvantages. That they say that there is no one disadvantage that just comes on its own without relationship to other disadvantages. For example, to be old usually is linked to be ill or to be poor, and it's a cluster of disadvantages. I called a process of disadvantage accumulation. These philosophers whose names are De Chalit and I forgot the other name. I have to remember that. They are arguing mostly the same process of accumulation of disadvantages. So probably you are familiar with the literature of livelihoods and so on, in which we used to say that there were households that were having advantages against other households. For example, Sylvia Professor Shand, was very clear to show that extended households were extremely advantageous. I mean, they had advantages over other kinds of households. In this way, in this process I've been depicting here, I think the comparative advantages enjoyed by larger, older, extended households in the past have been lost. And the erosion of social systems of support and self-help is directly linked to labor markets that increasingly exclude workers. Persistent crisis and current economic policies have diluted the resourcefulness of the poor by eroding their capacity to use their most important asset, their labor force. So with this thing I finish, the fabric of community, whether it is at the family, that social fabric, whether it is at the family, the neighborhood, or the city level, is increasingly eroded by economic change. And I would argue that violence is not just another factor, it is intrinsic to this process. And thank you very much. I hope this was clear enough. So what's the dynamic, Syl?
I'm just not with the glass of water in, but it looks like your notepad next to you. I'm sorry, but hopefully you don't need it now. Okay, thank you very much indeed for that incredibly interesting, stimulating talk.
But incomplete, anyway.
I wonder what we should do. Should we sit down? Would you like to continue standing up?
Oh, let's sit down.
Yeah, okay. Well, you have to watch it, I think. I'm sure there's going to be loads and loads of questions. I've got a few, so I'm just going to use my chair's prerogative. Just to really ask about the gender dimension here, because, you know, back in the 1980s, when we were working in Guadalajara and Querétaro respectively, one of the main resources available to poor households was to actually mobilise female labour.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly between the beginning of the 1980s and the end of the 1980s, there was a total sea change in terms of, you know, men allowing their wives out to work, and so on and so forth. So I'm very interested in terms of, obviously, we know that female labour force participation has continued growing in Mexico since the 1980s, even though at not such a rapid rate of increase. So I'm very interested to know, you know, what's happening around gender there. Are we seeing more in the way of households actually being supported uniquely by female incomes? And I wondered if you could say something about that. Second, related to that, female-headed households are also increasing, so what might be the link between the feminization of income-generating responsibilities in the household and the feminization of headship? And last but not least, with Sarah Bradshaw and Brian Lineker, we've been looking at some very interesting work on new data produced by UN Women via CEPAM, which is showing us a rather disturbing tendency towards a re-feminization of poverty in Latin America, which seems somewhat odd, given that this has been, you know, we're talking about, you know, at least a decade or a decade and a half of conditional cash transfer programs. And as somebody that's worked on conditional cash transfer programs and done a major evaluation of Progresa Oportunidades Prospera, I wondered if you could actually say something about how effective Mexico's program has been in terms of actually just alleviating some of the clearly very distressing tendencies there are going on in terms of the erosion of work. You don't need to answer all of them, actually, but just one.
Thank you. Actually, yes, I won't probably touch most of the points you raised, and thank you very much for your comments and questions. Yes, we were very much interested in the gender question, and both our research, your research, my research, research from others in Mexico, showed the greatest importance of, the great importance of women's labor on this way that, the families were going, getting along through crisis and so on, through women's labor, basically. Actually, my research on the impact of the economic crisis on the well-being of households, it was a diachronic processual research, which I followed the same households over one decade. So it was quite obsessive of mine, an obsession of mine. And it clearly showed that basically women's labor and the participation of women in the labor market was one of the main, let's say, responses of families and households to the diminishing of males' incomes. So these women came massively into the labor market, and that was documented and, of course, taken very seriously into account in both my work and many others. And by the way, it is interesting that anthropologists and people like you in geography, that we collect our own data. That we go and take the pulse of society through our field works. It's interesting that we can actually talk about results very quickly, or in a sense faster than many other social scientists who are depending on surveys, for example, and particularly if they are official surveys. So I remember when I was actually giving my first preliminary results in a SOMEDE conference in 1985, showing the crucial importance of these women going into the labor market, married women, women with children, women without education, which was a different profile of women engaged in the labor market before. I mean, before the crisis, it was women without children, mostly of them quite highly educated, or at least mediumly educated, but not without credentials at all, without education at all, and basically without children and without domestic responsibilities. And the crisis forced all these women who were mothers, mothers of young children, for example, to actually go and find a job in the informal sector, of course, because the formal jobs were decreasing very dramatically. And I remember our friends Orlandina Oliveira and Brigida Garcia, who are very famous gender experts and labor market experts in Mexico from El Colegio de Mexico. They really didn't like my results, and they thought that I was really mistaken because, well, according to them, there was no evidence that these women could be finding a job because the job market was a complete chaos. And it was interesting that after 4 or 5 years, when they had the most recent survey in their hands and they analyzed that survey, the microdata, they found exactly the same thing as I had said 5 years before. And I really think that is interesting. And of course, women in Mexico have not increased their presence in the labor market as in other Latin American countries. For example, Colombia, Argentina, Brazil. Brazil is more similar to Mexico. In Colombia and Brazil and Chile and Argentina, women are really, the figures of working women are extremely high compared to Mexico's or to Brazil's, in which, I mean, I don't have the figures right now, but they don't, they reach probably 40-45% of women, working age women, actually engaged in wage occupations. But that is very questionable because also surveys do not actually get the real picture. And women, many times, they hide their occupations because of social prestige or social constraints or something like that. I remember asking women being in their homes in those years when the massive entrance of women in the labor market was going on, and they used to say, "No, I'm not working. I do not work." And you could see the actual evidence. I mean, for example, shoes that were being produced by these women, and when you were pointed out the fact that you can see the evidence of her work, she or they would say, "Oh, that's not work. That's I do that in order to help my husband." So work considered as help. The things of course changed, and even though women's participation in the labor market is not as high, as I said, as in other countries in Latin America, those women who entered the labor market didn't withdraw. So they are still working in the labor market. And I think feminization of household economies continues to be a very important issue and a very important topic and question. And as you mentioned, Silvia, women's headed households have continued to rise in all these years. And I would say that, yes, well, we have a book, by the way, it's not Silvia's, and it's a book that I coordinated, and Silvia has a brilliant article there, chapter. And we argue that even though these households increased during all these years, past years, they are, their economies are the result, of course, of their work but also of the result of children's work. Work in aid children, not. By the way, CCT programs, yes, you touch one very close to my heart and close to my research trajectory in the past years. I did research for 10 years following the changes that the CCT Mexican program was producing in the lives of the poor, both in rural and urban settings. And yes, to be short, to give you a very short, very biased perhaps answer, no, CCT programs have not been able to alleviate fully the problems and the dramatic effects that the economic change has produced and the structural constraints have produced in women's and households' lives. But they have produced important changes. By the way, Thursday we are going to have the Superclasse MasterCard. No, unfortunately, there is not going to be MasterClass. MasterCard for anybody. Anyway, I circulated a paper of mine, which talks. It's in English, for those who don't speak Spanish. It points out the main changes that this type of the CCT program in Mexico has produced in the lives of young girls and women in general. So even though it has not been able to alleviate the economic lives of these people, the education attainment of girls has dramatically has increased very, very positively. In the sense that the gender gap in education attainment has actually reversed. When the program started in 1997, the huge gender gap that was incredibly clear. I mean, there was a huge gender gap between in terms of education, level of education, have reached, and so on. And now girls are actually, and you can see that in the census already, it's not only the crazy ethnographers who go to the countryside and to the communities and talk to people, but the results that we documented in our many, many, many reports and articles and papers and so on is actually visible in official data. So women are now more educated than men. I'm talking about youngsters. I mean, young people, and women are at least the ones I have studied in those 10 years of research are really making interesting decisions and taking interesting paths, very different to those of her mothers and her grandmothers. For example, fecundidad, fertility. Fertility is not fertility, is the rate of... they are postponing the age in which they become mothers. Those girls who are actually doing university degrees, for example, oportunidades is scholarships holders, women who were supported by the program along this whole time since the beginning of the program to 2008 when it was my last research in that kind of thing. So that research showed that women were postponing the age of maternity, and they were actually doing things that their mothers and grandmothers didn't even think to do, like getting a degree in a university. I don't know how, I'm not talking about quality of education, I'm just talking about education attainment and the levels they reach.
Thank you, Mitchell, very much. I'm sure there's lots of questions. What would you like to take maybe two or three?
Mm-hmm.
Wondering about these social networks and the ways in which they, it seems like they're really important and that they need to be formed. And so in order for them to form, is it just a matter of removing poverty from the equation, or does a proper sector that facilitates the spaces for these social networks to form necessary, something that's organized, like a charity sector in the United Kingdom, for instance?
I didn't really get the question.
Like, in order for these social networks to form, do you need an organized sector that allows for these spaces to, for these social networks to form in these spaces?
Or money?
Yes. Both, right? I mean, you would need to fund that sector to begin with.
Martina?
We asked about gender. Now I'm now asking about the rural-urban difference, the dissonance between social isolation and precariousness of work, whether you found that to be the same in the rural agrarian sector as well as in the urban poor sector.
I just wanted to ask you to go back to the very last point you made before you finished, when you said that violence is intrinsic to this process, and I just wondered sort of if you could elaborate on how you realize that a little more, because I found that really interesting.
Megan and then Carl.
Yes, I think I'm going to start from the bottom. That is with your question. Yeah, the characteristics of social isolation. Basically, it is, in my view, when I talk about social isolation, I am talking about these people which I have been interviewing, doing case studies, and so on, who say that they do not have, I mean, that they are no longer in touch with their kin, for example, their relatives, that they used to, but they no longer are visiting their parents or their siblings and so on. And when you try to go through more explanations from them, I always find the economic power, I mean, the economic explanation. They say, well, you know, I used to visit my siblings or my brother or my mother, but, you know, it's always good to bring something with you. It's not an obligation, according to them. It's actually not an obligation. But it's nice if you can actually bring something, like some food that you cooked, or some flowers, or a little plant for your mother to have in her garden, and so on. And I don't have the money to buy that. So it's a gradual process of being detached from your social relationships, which used to be, by the way, extremely important. I mean, they are important. I mean, I'm not saying that all Mexicans or all poor Mexicans have or are not right now socially isolated. This, as all the previews, I mean, I don't know if I can go back. Yes. I like this guy. How can I make it larger?
Let me do the techniques.
The thing is that I have a... Oops. Oh, Silvia, what are you doing?
Gorda. Which one? You want this one? Right, okay.
Yes, thank you very much. Actually, I like the Verre for many reasons. But one of the reasons is that he says, well, I'm going to be talking about coping here, but let's do it with precaution. Because when you are dealing with people, when you are doing research in a group, of in a country, in a neighborhood, in a society, which is formed by people who eat only once a day, and you say they are coping with economic stress, then you are probably wrong, because that is not really the result of coping. I'm going to remind, I mean, my memory is right now working. When I wrote the article which I titled Private Adjustments for UNDP in the year 2000, I was part of a group. I was the only woman, by the way. The other guys were men. And we were led by a very, very experimented guy from Pakistan, who obviously did, I mean, he made his life out of consultancies. I haven't really made more than two or three consultancies in my life. And he obviously was very experimented in the area of consultancy for these international agencies. And I was very worried because I was reviewing the data of studies carried out in a lot of countries, including Latvia, including many countries in Africa, and many other places. That is data which was collected through projects financed by United Nations, by UNDP. And the idea was to make sense of some of these data. So I chose the data which came from qualitative studies, not precisely ethnographic, but qualitative studies. And I had this wonderful array of data which I was dealing with. I decided I was going to stop talking about coping strategies. And then the guy, the leader of the team, said, oh, forget about the data which you are talking about. I mean, you just continue talking about coping. And I thought, oh my God, this is really something. Because it doesn't matter what is going on in the real world. I mean, the important thing is to emphasize and to be repeating the rhetoric and repeating the argument that makes sense to bureaucrats, to international bureaucrats. And I thought, this is not me. I'm not going to do that. And I wrote that piece of work, which I still like, Private Adjustments, in which I emphasize, and it was the first time, not in my own work in Guadalajara, I had started thinking about social isolation and the real social costs of these terrible crisis, economic crisis, and so on. And that's part of my answer. But I also want to give you the example of this guy. I mean, Eric Klinenberg, in his study of the heat wave, he says, well, I mean, he actually goes into detail and describes the house of one of these men who died. And the evidence is appalling. I mean, not only for the filthy environment, but also for the lack of evidence of social networking. For example, a man, an old man who died in that heat wave. His flat was full of rubbish. His flat had a calendar in which he, the deceased, was writing important events in his life, and it was empty. I mean, and there was nobody to knock at his door. The same thing happened with the other victims of the heat wave, in which you can actually see that, I mean, even the bodies were not found until it was actually too late, and until when the smell was really too horrible. And then the neighbors made a call, and they found that the poor person was deceased for at least 2 or 3 days. And yeah,
that story is incredibly sad.
Yeah, well, probably it's not enough to give you an answer for how I characterize social isolation, but it goes more or less on that rule.
Unfortunately, we have to vacate the room at 6 o'clock. But
how
delightful is it that Meche is going to be with us this evening? I know some of you are coming for dinner, but before that, we're going to go for a drink. Ryan, would you suggest that George? Yeah, I'll be for the white. Okay.
Well, I am very sorry I didn't answer the questions.
But all of those other questions, I'm sure Meche will answer over a drink. And of course, there are other questions.
Because I did want to talk about migration and so on.
We're gonna further the discussion, and we're gonna give Meche a big round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you.